Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
With your host, Andrew Donaldson, this is Heard Tell.
Welcome. I'm Andrew Donaldson. Thank you so much for joining us. The most precious thing you have, your time. So we try to turn down the noise of the news cycle, get to things that matter, skip over the things that don't, and try to discern our times as best we can. Let's go to Moore County, North Carolina. That's the Carthage area, parts of Southern Pines, that sort of area of North Carolina, the Sand Hills. This story is troubling for a couple of reasons. One is because this was one that really needed a 24-hour, 72-hour, 48-hour rule on not jumping to conclusions because everybody online went wild with it. But the core that we now know from authorities and what's being reported is important enough. Let's go to WRAL here. And here's what we do know happened. Carthage, North Carolina, by the WRAL.com. We'll link to this. All Moore County schools are closed on Monday, and the American Red Cross has opened a 24-hour shelter to help thousands of people lacking heat, medical care, and other necessities during a mass outage. Nearly 40,000 customers lost power over the weekend after a massive outage caused by damage to substations by gunfire. The outage started Saturday at 7 p.m., and power may not be restored until Thursday, according to Duke Energy. On Monday at 12 a.m., 33,000 people were without power, according to Duke Energy's outage map. The temperatures dropped below freezing Monday morning, and it was 29 degrees for multiple hours. Two substations, were targeted in a gunfire attack, leading to multiple equipment failures, according to Moore County Sheriff's Office. The substations are around 5 miles apart, located in West End and Carthage. Moore County Sheriff Ronnie Fields said just before midnight that the outage was being investigated as a criminal occurrence. A state of emergency was declared in Moore County Sunday at 4 p.m., and curfew is in place from 9 p.m. to 5 a.m. The curfew is because the power outages are so severe. That includes roads along, lights along the roads, traffic lights, everything. So it's actually dangerous to be out on these darkened roads. That's why they did the curfew. This is also a high transit area for people traveling. We faced something last night in Moore County we've never faced before, Sheriff Fields said at the press conference. Fields said that the crews at the substation found extensive damage, that's in quotes. When inspecting the equipment, he also said there was evidence that firearms had been used to disable the equipment. They're working with state and local law enforcement. By the way, the feds are involved now, the FBI is there, to continue the investigation. When asked if this was an incident of domestic terrorism, Fields replied, "I can't answer that. This was targeted. It wasn't random." Investigators aren't sure if there's a tie between the substation damage and things going on in the community. There was heavy security at a local drag show at the Sunrise Theater in Southern Pines. See, this is where I'm going to stop. They don't know that these two things are related. What happened was some folks with some very untoward histories online kind of sort of hinted that this might be why it is, and folks have been running with it. But until it's proved, everybody needs to calm down with that, okay? This is in Carthage. Southern Pines is a little bit different area, although they are somewhat close. So just automatically putting those two things together isn't it, folks. Now, if it turns out that's what it is, we'll deal with it when we get there. Long story short, there's a couple things we need to talk about here, though. This is cowardly, in the words of Sheriff Fields, is what I call it. We don't have anything, no motivation, no group to step forward to acknowledge or accept what has been done. I call them cowards. He's correct. We've talked about before on here, infrastructure like power grids are very easy targets for somebody that really wants to do something. Now, we don't know the motivation here, whether it was a political motivation, just some crazy person gone off, or somebody's upset at Duke for taking their power off, and they went and shot up two substations. In fact, they shot up two different ones. Means that this is probably a little more planned than what we thought, because you'd have to look that sort of thing up. It is domestic terrorism, though, whatever the motive turns out to be here, and we'll continue to cover it. But this is a domestic terrorism thing. This is a big deal for people to not have power, especially on a cold night. People need their power, especially folks that have medical equipment at home, like oxygen tanks and other things. Elderly people have to have heat. This is not a joke. This is very serious. Now, whatever happens here and turns out, we should learn the lesson that our infrastructure is vulnerable to not only the crazy makers of the world, but could be vulnerable to other people with more means and more sophisticated methods of attack. And it's something that needs to be addressed. It's something that hasn't been addressed for decades, although people have warned about it. So two things to take away from this Moore County story. One is, let the investigation breathe. Like we said, put in a little bit of a rule and just wait. It looks a little different now than it looked on Sunday. Don't just follow what's going on social media. By the way, a lot of those people talking big on social media and acting like they may have something to do with it, may not. They just want the credit for it. So that's why you got to wait for the investigation to play out. Just let this thing breathe. We'll find out the investigation. We'll go from there. But it's yet another example of how our critical infrastructure is vulnerable. And anybody that attacks that infrastructure, whether domestic, foreign, or a purple hippopotamus, it is terrorism. This terrorizes people's lives. It puts people's lives in danger. Darkened roads with the lights off, that's dangerous. People at home medical with elderly folks and sick folks that need their equipment, that's dangerous. Cold weather alone can kill people. This is terrorism. And whoever did it ought to have the absolute full extent of the law put upon them and get justice really quickly for what is clearly a despicable act. The sheriff's right. This was a cowardly thing to do because substations don't shoot back. But our criminal justice system should deal with this swiftly once we find out who's involved. And we better learn the lesson. Our critical infrastructure is very, very vulnerable. Better start thinking about it. We're all going to be in a world of hurt come someday when somebody really gets a head up to try to hurt the American people. More Hurt Tell right after this.
Springtime savings are in full bloom, all in the Kroger app. Get 12 packs of delicious Coca-Cola, Pepsi, or 7-Up for $4.99 each with a digital coupon. Then get one-pound packages of flavorful 80% lean Angus ground beef chuck for $3.99 each, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger today, or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Welcome back to Hurt Tell. Okay, somebody we'd love to talk to because he's insightful, he's smart, he brings good perspective on things. Joshua Crawford, back on the program, another one of our great Young Voices contributors. He's the director of criminal justice initiatives at the Georgia Center of Opportunity, and he's one of these lawyer fellows. But for the purposes of this conversation, we will not hold that against him. How are you, sir? Good to see you again.
I'm doing well, and I appreciate that.
No problem. Here's what I'd like to do, because we've talked to you before. I think we need to go a little big picture on this stuff, because when it comes to things like crime, when it comes to things like criminal justice, when it comes to things like recidivism, we tend to take our pet project and talk about that, or we talk about a breaking news headline and we talk about that, and we don't weave everything together into the one big quilt of making things better. So I want to start with this, though. When we talk about the justice system, and especially the incarceration system, is supposed to be reformative, and it's not. Mm-hmm. How much of a piece of what we're seeing in our society when it comes to things like criminal justice is that we don't seem to be really reforming criminals? We seem to have a criminal justice system that makes more criminals than it prevents. How big a piece of the story is that?
Yeah, so as it relates to the number of people who end up reoffending after release, it's a huge part of the piece. When you look at 10-year reviews of individuals who've been released from the criminal justice system, about 8 in 10 have committed a new offense over that 10-year period. So that's a 80% failure rate. It's not a success rate, it's a failure rate, really. And so part of the criminal justice system exists for two reasons. The first reason is to apprehend, prosecute and remove from civil society those people who are preying on the vulnerable, right? That's its first goal. Its second goal is, to the extent possible, to reduce crime. And so when you're talking about successfully re-entering people into civil society, it's a big part of that second question, and one that we really do a poor job of.
Yeah, Joshua Crawford joining us. We've got all the data in the world. You were writing about this in Real Clear Policy, and we'll link to it. The formula for somebody who has criminal stuff on their record: stable home environment, stable work environment equals success. That's the formula. It's inarguable.
Yep.
But getting into work and getting a stable home situation for these folks after they have some kind of criminal justice issue, whether it's full-blown incarceration or probation or whatever, even juvie offenders, we see this as they enter adulthood. Those are the barriers. That's the data. Well, we know what it needs, and we know what the stigmas are, and we know what the problem is. Why are we hitting such a brick wall and trying to punch through that?
Yeah, one of the major problems is that we do a tremendous amount of programming in prisons that teach technical skills. So you can further your education, you can become a licensed barber, you can become, learn various skills for various trades. And all of that stuff is valuable and good, especially when you talk about engaging in the workforce. But what we do a really bad job of is a lot of those sort of life skill type things. So the things that bring people to prison are the same things that prevent them from forming meaningful relationships and from existing in stable work environments. Because if you can't show up for work on time, if you can't pass a drug test, if you can't solve a dispute without that dispute turning physical, then you're not going to last very long in the workforce, and you're not going to maintain very many relationships, regardless of the technical skills that you may have. And so one of the things that some of the more recent research has focused on is, how do you improve those sort of soft skill type things to help people more meaningfully reintegrate into civil society?
Yeah, Joshua Crawford joining us. You just hit on something really important that doesn't get talked enough about. When you're in the system, and I'm going to use that broadly, not just incarceration, but just, you know, the fine system, the court system, the way you sit through pretrial confinement, all of these things. Everybody has, and rightfully so, concerns about violent crime. You talk about it all the time. You've been writing about it. We're going to link to some of your writing about violent crime. Talk about this piece of it. You just mentioned it. We have nonviolent offenders going into the system, and they come out violent offenders because of what they undergo in the system. And it's not excusing them completely or making it like they don't have some responsibility for that. But it's just very clear in the data that we're creating violent criminals that were otherwise not violent people because of the way the system works. How do we address that?
So here's one of the really interesting things that is currently somewhat debated among criminal justice professionals, academic criminologists, and so on and so forth, is you take a guy who, let's say he was a high-risk offender when he went in, and he's got a stellar record while he's incarcerated. He's not getting in fights. He's not giving staff a hard time. He's not smuggling in contraband. He's doing pretty well. And then he gets back out into the streets after he's released, and he's rearrested pretty quickly. Well, what happened? The sort of canned answer for most of the time that people have looked at this is to say, like, well, the environment is criminogenic, right? He went back out in the same environment that he came into, and so it was really tough for him, et cetera, et cetera. Well, that kind of falls apart when you think about it a little bit past stage one, which is to say this: when someone is incarcerated, 100% of their peer group are also criminals, right? And that's sort of a crude way to say it, but it's true. You're talking about a population where the overwhelming majority of people who are there have pled or been found guilty to some sort of criminal offense. And yet, despite that environment, many people still are able to do very well. And it's because of the structure and the supervision and the incentive to get out and all of this kind of stuff that people can behave in the short term. But how can you transition that to making sure people are successful on the back end? And one of the things that seems to be really critical is making sure that the staff, the programming staff that you're working with inside the facility, are communicating with any sort of parole staff that you have once you get out. So there's that sort of continuum of care that we talk about in healthcare and in drug treatment, applying that to the release process from jail or prison has been demonstrated to have some better outcomes.
Yeah, Joshua Crawford joining us. There you go, another problem. This is why I talk about this is a holistic thing if you're going to try to deal with this, because every tentacle of this has another problem.
Right.
You just talked about prison staffing and correctional staffing.
Yep.
These are super hard jobs with abysmal pay and really hard hours.
Yeah.
These are not high-level jobs where people go and seek them out. We're not recruiting our best people for these jobs. And yet you just mentioned it. These are jobs that are critically important on a human level to human beings that are being dealt with in a human way. How do we fix that? Because that seems to be a core alloy on what's coming out of our prison system. And this is not knocking the people that already work there. Mm-hmm. It's just it is what it is. You've got to have better staff to have better prisons. And I don't see that coming anywhere on the horizon. Is that a fair way to assess it?
Yeah, it is a huge problem. I mean, the recruitment and retention crisis that law enforcement is facing right now gets a lot of attention, but it's equally severe as it relates to corrections officials. Part of that answer is going to have to be better pay for those positions in sort of the age of inflation and the $15 minimum wage everywhere. There are jobs that are competing with talent for those positions that you wouldn't necessarily think of, right? If you can work at Home Depot and make comparable pay to working in a prison facility, you're going to work at Home Depot 10 times out of 10. So that's part of it. Part of it is adequately training staff and making sure that they are able to thrive in that environment and do well. And then part of it is changing up the actual infrastructure of the prison, right? A lot of the prisons in this country are built to be directly supervised by individuals. And when that's the case, then you need a lot of staff to supervise a lot of people. The newer facilities are sort of built to be supervised by a combination of technology and staff. And so you can supervise more people with fewer people. You can be more particular in the people that you recruit into the facility. And so some of those technological advancements and changes may alleviate some of these problems. And that's the benefit to sort of market forces and innovation and technology.
Yeah, Joshua Crawford joining us. Let's talk market forces for a second. If in the abstract, we have economists on the show all the time, because I don't know a lot about economy and I'm really bad at math. So I get economists on, like you, you're a lawyer. I get you on because you're an expert on this. We talk to economists all the time. If I told one of them that we could put a 500,000 strong workforce into a state, they would just lose their minds with giddiness, because that would be a great game changer for them.
Yeah.
You talk about this, though. In the state of Georgia, there's 500,000 people under the state supervision right now.
Right.
There's another 500,000 or so with a felony on their record. 12% of the adult population that could be working in the state of Georgia has a felony, which limits their working ability.
Right.
You can't tell me if you got some reform there and got even if you got 20, 30, 10% of those folks working, that would show up economically in a positive way, not to mention what it would do for their own lives and their own families.
Yeah.
Why don't we ever look at it that way?
So part of it, and you know, you talked about this from the outset, is that there are so many moving parts here that you have to be somewhat particular in what you're talking about. Many of those individuals that you just talked about are violent or sexual offenders. Some of them are recidivist property offenders that reoffend almost immediately after release. But a very large percentage of them are people who want to meaningfully reenter civil society. And so how can you create structures that incentivize folks to do that, and still the public has confidence that they're not going to be served at some restaurant by a child murderer who, you know, got some lenient sentence, right? And so the particulars and the nuance matter a tremendous amount. But as it relates to that population of low-level property offenders, low-level drug offenders who have spent a period of time crime-free, there is absolutely no reason to not do everything we can to meaningfully reintegrate those folks into civil society, because it means fewer victims, it means more economic growth, it means better labor force participation rates. And so we can do both. And you mentioned this, I write a lot about violent crime. I write a lot about gang violence. Those are things that we ought to be very tough on. Those are things that we ought to take very seriously. But at the same time, we ought to be able to say that, hey, there's this population of folks out here who want to work, and it's the system that is preventing them from working. Once they demonstrate seriousness about reentering society, then we ought to get serious too.
Yeah, Joshua Crawford, join us. Put your lawyer hat on for just a second, though, because let's be grown folks here. Mm-hmm. There's liability issues there, and there's parsing out issues, and employers already have a hard enough time parsing through who's going to be a good employee and not, let alone parsing through a criminal record and psychological evals and these sort of things. Where's something to work on that? Is it, do we need different classifications for felonies? Like you just said, like not all, a bank guy does a form wrong, winds up with a felony because he misreported something, is not somebody that killed somebody. You know, there's different kinds of, do we need some nomenclature change? Do we need some regulatory reform where maybe employers get a little bit of liability protection for taking these kind of folks on? Is there some things, not even big laws, but like state legislation level kind of regulatory reforms to kind of open some of these doors up a little bit? Is that a way to address some of these things?
Yeah, the liability protections for second chance employers are becoming more popular around the country. So are occupational licensing reforms that in many jurisdictions simply prohibited felons from acquiring a license. Oftentimes that's being replaced by a structure that says that there must be some nexus between the felony committed and the license sought. In other words, if you've got a drug conviction and you want to be a barber, there's no relationship between the two. But if you've got a fraud conviction and you want to be an accountant or a financial advisor, then maybe there is some nexus that the licensing board can take into consideration. And so, again, injecting some nuance where there hasn't been before can really improve that, whether it be the liability protections or some of these occupational licenses changes.
Yeah, I mentioned nomenclature there. Talk about that for just a second for folks, because most people just hear, oh, felony conviction.
Yeah.
Is there a way there that we need to kind of change our own language when we're discussing these things, when we talk about, well, convict, inmate, prior offender, felony, not felony? People don't know classifications of felonies for the large part. Give us some nomenclature stuff when we're just discussing this, like on our own social media or discussing it, or even in a policy situation, that we should probably be talking about it a little bit differently, so we're advancing the ball, not just rehashing terms that don't really have a meaning to it other than being a negative to the folks involved.
Yeah, unfortunately, the deeper you look at that, the more complex it gets, right? So you'll hear people talk about nonviolent felonies sometimes, or violent felonies, and those things typically have a definition in statute. Here in Kentucky and in a lot of places, attempted murder is technically a nonviolent felony. So it's even unfair. If you say this person's committed a nonviolent felony, they may have committed an attempted murder. And so it's quite complex that way. There have been attempts in the past to sort of move away from all categorization like that. I think that's a mistake too, because I think what it does is it no longer holds people accountable and attempts to sort of not acknowledge the past or past behavior. And oftentimes what leads to success for people in terms of reentering is to not only come to terms with their prior actions, but to sort of accept the wrong nature of those prior actions and to want to do better, right? A lot of the folks that I work with are people that have been in jail or prison before, and the ones who are most successful at finding meaning outside of prison are those who look back at what they did and say, like, I was wrong for doing that. Now, that gives us no guidance on whether that should be a 5-year sentence or a probation sentence or whatnot. But you're primarily talking about people who in sober moments are able to recognize the wrong of what they did.
Yeah, Joshua Crawford. I want to go back to something you wrote a little while back. You wrote about Chicago, and you were talking about violent crime. Look, Chicago's become the bloody shirt for the right when it comes to violent crime. It just is. That's the one they always go to. Chicago also has some ingrained, embedded problems. Like every city has its own little things. Chicago's got some embed things that make it unique to everything else. I don't find it super helpful for us to just keep yelling, well, look at the murder rate in Chicago, because that doesn't really do anything. Right. You did more than that. You dug into it. You went through the numbers. This is another one of those things, like how we've talked about this, I think is perpetuating the problem. Right. What's a better way to talk about when somebody goes, well, oh, look, you know, remember back during the war on terror, I was like, oh, well, more people die in Chicago than they do in Iraq, which wasn't a fair comparison, but you heard this kind of nonsense.
Yeah.
What's a better way to discuss something like Chicago? Because there's lessons to be learned there if we do it in a productive way, right?
Yeah. So Chicago is somewhat unique in that it has a very long history of an ingrained gang culture in some of its neighborhoods. It's like Los Angeles that way. There are a number of cities, especially large cities, that have just had hierarchical gang structures for longer periods of time. And there are consequences that come from that versus a city like Louisville or Milwaukee, where those structures are relatively new and still somewhat disorganized and smaller. So there are some unique problems there. But one of the things that I never do is I try never to say high crime neighborhood. And part of the reason I try to never say that is because there is no neighborhood in the United States of America in any city in which the majority of residents are out committing crimes, especially not violent or serious crimes. In every city in the country and in every neighborhood in that city where there are higher rates of violent crime, you're talking about a very small number of people who are very active and making like miserable for the overwhelming majority of people who live in that neighborhood. And when you start to think about things like this, you realize that it's not a territory to be occupied by law enforcement and where there need to be large numbers of arrests, but there are small numbers of networks and groups that need to be disrupted, in some cases arrested, incarcerated for long periods of time. But the primary beneficiary of that should be the law-abiding citizens in that neighborhood, which are the overwhelming majority of residents in all of those neighborhoods.
Yeah, Joshua Crawford joining us. All right, let's go to one of the nuts of all these problems. Whether it's, you know, criminal recidivism rates, whether it's violent crimes on the streets, whether it's corruption, whatever, folks holding their local and city and state and federal government accountable is kind of the linchpin to all this stuff. Mm-hmm. They tend to demand attention on this stuff when crime is high, or when there's a high profile thing, or there's a police shooting, or there's a crime wave or a terrorist attack, and then this stuff falls out of the news and nobody pays attention to it.
Yeah.
What's the baby steps, the stuff they should be doing between the headlines for folks that really care about their community? Because again, almost every city, county, whatever your municipality is, they have some sort of public interest groups that the police have to go and sit in front of you, and they have to take public questions, whether it's a city council, county commission, whatever. A lot of cities now have various groups where the police are responsive to the community. What do they do about stuff like that to start advancing the ball a little bit instead of just chasing headlines on social media and yelling at the TV?
Yeah, I think that last part is key, and I think it relates to a lot of that stuff, which is to first and foremost understand the actual desires of the community that you are attempting to help. Right. There are a lot of, to be frank, white suburbanites who advocate on behalf of black urban communities with high rates of crime or high rates of negative interactions with law enforcement, and sort of pretend to know what that community wants. If you don't actually know what that community wants, then you ought to find out what that community wants before taking some sort of attempt to rectify the problem as you see it. But the other thing is to understand that what most people want is the same across the board. Most people want safe streets and safe communities. They want policing done in a transparent and ethical way, but they want the problem children, if you will, removed from the neighborhood. They want other people largely left alone. They want to have positive interactions with law enforcement. And so understanding and talking about these things when crime is not going up, part of the problem that we're facing right now is the United States experienced 23 years of sustained crime declines, both violent and property crime, for 23 years. And what happened was a lot of people kind of, you know, brushed their hands off and said, well, we figured this out. we can clean our hands and go worry about something else. And when the eye was taken off the ball, all of a sudden things started to get worse and some really bad ideas started to gain some headwind. And so now I think this time period sort of serves as a reminder to folks that, like literally all other areas of public policy, be it tax or education or otherwise, this is not an area that we are ever going to figure out and walk away from and be able to not care about, that there needs to be constant evaluation, constant innovation, and we need to constantly be trying to get better.
Joshua Crawford, it's cyclical. And we can look back through, you know, the 80s, the 90s, the 2000s. Economic growth and crime have an inverse relationship with each other in a lot of cases. There's things like this. There is a cycle to this stuff. Where do you see this going in the next few years? We're getting ready to have a presidential election cycle. I know everybody's tired because we just did midterms, but let's be grown, folks.
Yeah.
We're going to have an election cycle. Crime made a difference in the midterms. We've got the data now. Voters were thinking about that along with the economy and other things.
Yep.
So I suspect we're going to hear a lot about crime for the next 2 years running into the next election cycle. How do we parse out the noise of what is just, like you said, people just yelling about all those, that bad crime and fear mongering, and people that actually have some policy ideas to try to fix it? Give us a few things to cut through the noise we're going to hear in the coming years to get to what we actually need to be paying attention to. It's like, oh, that person's just throwing buzzwords at me, or this candidate actually knows what they're talking about and cares about this issue.
Yeah. You know, I think both parties tend to retreat to high level sort of buzzwords on this issue. And it can be, it can make the discourse worse. But the first and most fundamental thing for people to understand is that it's a relatively small number of people who commit most of the serious violence. In any given city, you're talking about 0.5% of your population that's responsible for more than 50% of your violence. And so politicians that understand that, right, understand the way that crime concentrates among individuals and concentrates among micro locations. Again, you're talking about less than 5% of one block street segments in a given city are responsible for more than 50% of all crime, not just violence. And so understanding the concentration is true there. The other thing is that the solutions that work best are when there are combinations of sort of official structures, be it law enforcement, corrections, prosecutors, and the community, social services, and so on and so forth. Anyone who relies too heavily on one of those two sides or talks exclusively about one to the exclusion of the other either isn't serious about the issue, is just an ideologue, or doesn't understand the actual technical literature on this. You can do a lot with law enforcement. You can do a lot with social services. But for the social service example, there is not a single instance of citywide crime reduction in the United States in which an effort was done to the exclusion of law enforcement. That's not to say that law enforcement is itself the answer, but the partnership between the two, the sort of soft with the hard, is where this stuff works best.
And Joshua Crawford joins. And the reason that is because when you get past the policy and the buzzwords and all that, this is a human problem.
Mm-hmm.
How much of this is trying to balance still seeing even the worst of the worst of the offenders as humans, making sure we see the police as humans, seeing these communities as humans, not just demographic blocks or voter blocks or whatever you want to call it. I see when these things go bad in the discussion and policy realm is when we don't do that and we dehumanize any of those groups. How important is it to keep everybody involved here as a human being first and foremost?
Yeah, absolutely. And at the risk of sounding like one of your economist guests, people respond to incentives, right? And sometimes people respond better to negative stimuli. Sometimes people respond better to positive stimuli. But again, when it's a combination of the two, you tend to get the best results. And so the strategies that work best leverage both of those things and try to get folks not only to not commit the crimes and not stay on a negative life course, but actually on to a positive life course. And that is far easier to do. And they are far more successful when they take the sort of two-track path.
Yeah, which brings us right back where we started is, you know, stable home lives and employment. That's the path to happiness for everybody, whether, you know, that's why we talk about college graduates. Well, you've got an education, you can have a stable life and employment.
Yep.
And it just boggles my mind that we're like, look, we got to have barriers for the folks that are really struggling, whether it's criminal record wise or mental health wise or whatever. They got to have stable health and they got to have a employment path. That's the trick to all this, because when people don't have meaningful employment, meaningful lives, they turn to bad things. Like it's so simple, yet we really seem to drop the ball on it. It just amazes me. Does it still amaze you?
Yeah. James Q. Wilson, who was sort of like the guy right of center on these issues for decades, in his book, Thinking About Crime, talks about basically the three categories of people that exist. On the one end of the spectrum, there are the people that we can do absolutely nothing to dissuade from committing criminal offenses, either because of interpersonal reasons or lack of, or however you want to attribute it, they are determined to do whatever it is they are going to do. On the other end of the spectrum, because of internal social controls and morality and things like that, there's nothing you could do to push them to commit a violent offense. You could make all of these things legal and they'd still choose not to participate. But the great swath in the middle are people who are watching, seeing how we respond to things, seeing how society responds to things, and will act accordingly. And so, again, creating all of your structures so that you punish the wrongdoer, you reintegrate the person who has done the wrong into civil society, and we can all sort of progress, right? You don't let misbehavior go unpunished, but you don't perpetually punish. Again, except in the cases which you intend to perpetually punish, right? Like there's a role for sort of life sentences or something like that, right? But unless you're saying we're giving this person a life sentence, 95%+ of all inmates will be released at some point. Making sure those people don't commit more crimes when they come out is good for everybody. It's good for public safety. It's good for offenders. It's good for victims. It's good for all of us.
Yeah, I think that's the key. You just said it right there. It's good for everybody. It's good for society. The more freedom and opportunity you give to the most people is the best for everybody. And that's something we tend to lose track of when we start talking about these sorts of things. Joshua Crawford, I always appreciate the high-level conversations we always get out of you, my friend. You're down there in the great state of Georgia working on things now, although you're still based out of Kentucky. That's a commute. Thank God for technology, right? Let folks know how they can keep up with you, what you have going on, the work you're doing, and how they can follow you until we get you back on Hertel again, my friend.
Yeah, so all my stuff will be on the Georgia Center for Opportunity's website. That's foropportunity.org. You can follow me on Instagram. It's jcrawford502. That is really the social media platform that I use, interact with folks, continue these conversations there.
Yes, sir. I always appreciate it. Great conversation. We'll do it again real soon, I promise. I love talking to you about these items. Thank you, sir. Joshua Crawford, appreciate the time.
Thank you.
Yes, sir. Welcome back to Hertel. Okay, this is one of the more bonkers things we've ever covered, so we're going to go through this real nice and slow so we can keep up with all the folks in Logan so they don't get too confused here. This is from grid.news via our friend Keith Conrad and his excellent listicle every day of the news side quest. Headline, DNA showed a mother was also her daughter's uncle. Read that again. DNA showed a mother was also her daughter's uncle. How scientists solve this medical mystery, from the pieces by Dan Vergano, the science reporter for Grid News. How can a paternity test suggest a mother is also her daughter's father? The answer to that medical mystery, sparked by a confusing paternity test result, is, quote, when the genes of a vanished twin brother live on in the mother's DNA, end quote. The finding, which genetic experts reported earlier this month, suggests that such things as human chimeras, people with DNA from more than one embryo, could be more common than we thought. What is the frequency of this? We don't really know, said Juan Yunus of Colombia's Instituto. You know what? This is a big Spanish word, and I'm just going to butcher it. So out of respect for the Spanish language, I'm going to leave that one alone. Only about 20 confirmed cases are documented, he said. Probably there are more and can be a profound effect on one's life. In recent decades, DNA studies have opened a new view on the truly messy biology of human reproduction, which is not always as textbook neat as health class imagines of a sperm meeting an egg and 9 months later you get a baby. The opening weeks of human development during pregnancy see rapid cell developments in embryos, all orchestrated by genetic shuffle that sometimes takes a more complicated course. That leads to outcomes ranging from triplets to miscarriages and other multiple things, which are thought to result from DNA abnormalities in about half of all known cases. One of the curious paths might lead to chimerism, where in an unknown number of cases, genes from a, quote, vanishing twin, end quote, end up mixed in with those of the surviving sibling. There's usually a few outward signs of the condition, leaving it to fly under the medical radar. Just so, the case Eunice presented at the International Symposium of Human Identification in Washington, D.C. in November was just a first a routine paternity test of a young girl, however, quickly turned confusing. First, some parts of the test suggested a mother's child's birth mother was not, in fact, her mother, what is known as a maternal exclusion result. Second, some others suggested the child's alleged father was not her father as a, quote, paternal exclusive result. Finally, the birth mother's blood sample tested as a male containing the XY chromosomes found in a biological man rather than the two XX chromosomes responsible for the female sex organs. Some intersex women, of course, have XY chromosomes and develop a female sexual anatomy, but they are usually infertile. So this confused everybody. Somebody made a mistake. There's a contamination in the lab. Stop everything, said Eunice of the initial reaction. However, the team saw identical results when they repeated the test with the original blood sample. When the scientists took the mother out of the test, showed the alleged father was clearly the father of the girl, and other male genes in the results disappeared, causing more confusion. The answer to this puzzle came in 2002 when Eunice was part of a team that reported the news of a 52-year-old woman named Karen Keegan. You knew it was going to be a Karen, didn't you, folks? Karen Keegan, whose genetic testing for a kidney transplant revealed that she was a tetragametic, I'm probably not saying that correctly, chimera, where tetra means four and gametes, means sex cells, so more than four sex cells, like sperms and eggs. Her genes were a mixture from four eggs and sperm cells instead of the normal two. Her genetics derived from two separate fertilized eggs that fused early on. When her mother was pregnant with her, in Keegan's case, both embryos were XX or biologically female, according to the New England Journal of Medicine report on her case. The mother, described by Eunice this month as having an XY genetic signature predominant in her blood and saliva samples, confused the paternity test. But her hair and cheek cells show a predominance of XX cells. This kind of a mixed assortment of chromosome and different types of tissue, which grows separately starting early in the pregnancy, is a signature of chimerism. The appearance of what Y chromosome from a lost twin and other chimeric genes were what had confused the paternity result. The child's mother is a natural chimera, said Robert Wink, a genetic pathologist based in Baltimore. One twin, a male, fused with the other, female, twin, and disappeared in the early pregnancy. Although there are few published cases of chimerism, there are estimates that the condition may exist in up to 10% of the population. He added suggestive that this are findings of around 30% of births that initial tests suggest are twins lead to the birth of only one child, the quote, vanishing twin syndrome mentioned above. In rare cases of chimerism where either XY or XX cells don't predominate in the sexual organs, chimeric people can develop both male and female anatomy, a condition referred to as intersex, said Wink, but this is very unusual. Chimerism may be on the increase in the human population because of the worldwide increase in babies born through in vitro fertilization technology, more than 8 million in the last two decades. Often more than one embryo is implanted in the mother, and that increases the chances there may be embryos fusing, he said. Obviously, chimerism can be cause of all sorts of problem and confusing paternity tests, said Eunice, from loss of child support to divorces to welfare fraud cases like that of the Lydia Fairchild case in Washington State. Woman who almost lost her children after genetic tests suggested she was not her children's biological mother. Another telltale sign of the condition are large stripes of different pigmented skin, like those in the model Taylor Mule, who is another natural chimera. Such stripes as speckles, a 34-year-old man whose paternity test reported in 2015 suggested a brother he didn't have was the father of his children. A 2004 episode of the criminal drama CSI centered on a chimera who blamed his crimes on a vanished twin who left his DNA at the scene. But on a deeper level, the existence of natural chimerism plays a role in bioethicists' arguments over experiments on human embryos, with the observation that embryonic fusion led to the chimerism, or vice versa, only happens 2 weeks or less into a pregnancy. This time-limited partly explains the long-observed 14-day rule in biomedicine, keeping experiments on human embryos in the first 2 weeks of development. That is a threshold that the British developed biologist Anna McLean pointed to as the point where human identity begins and which is now under debate in scientific circles. Worth noting, the natural chimerism found in the paternity test case is different from the acquired kind that is far more common in adults, where mothers can gain genes of their children during fetal developments. In a follow-up with the family of the woman who confounded the paternity test, Eunice and his team also looked at her two older children, a girl and a boy, to see if they had received any chimeric genes. There are signs that some of their mother's chimeric uncle, quote-unquote, genes might have been passed along. And the thing is that nobody is looking for these cases, really, so we don't really know how many they are. That explains why my team wanted to look at the whole family when they found the case. They're trying to get their arms around the phenomenon. In particular, the paternity test team look to see if their son born earlier to the woman possessed her vanishing fraternal twins male chromosome, to see if there was a case of the Y chromosome transmittal from mother to son. But no, it was not a Nobel Prize winner. Lot to unpack there. Read it yourself. Grid.news will link to it. Folks, we don't know as much as we think we do about these things. Better have a little humility and wait and see on some of this stuff. More or tell later.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
That'll do it for Hertel. Thank you so much for being with us. We'd love to hear from you. Hertel Show on gmail.com. You can email us, Hertel Show at the Twitter. You can follow us along there. Of course, my social media. Feel free to reach out. We've done whole episodes and segments just based on what you want to talk about. Be happy to look at stories you think need to be covered, maybe aren't covered correctly, or you think need a different angle taken to them. We'd love to hear from you. So, wherever you and yours are, cross it. That sucked. Let me do that again. So, wherever you and yours are, across the street or around the world, we hope you're well. We hope you're well fed, and we can't wait to see you again next time for more Herd Tell. All the music on Herd Tell is provided under a creative content license from MonsterCat.com. Folks, if you've listened to the Herd Tell program, you've heard our friend Gabriella Hoffman, but you need to make sure you're checking out her podcast, District of Conservation. It's a podcast exploring the nuances of true conservation efforts from D.C. and beyond. From topic discussions to exclusive interviews with conservation and energy newsmakers, Gabriella keeps listeners appraised of the latest news stories while elevating important voices. Listen to District of Conservation on Apple Podcasts or wherever podcasts are played.